Hello, it's John Dennis on Thursday, the 16th of April. Today, the future of cars is electric. That's what the Transport Secretary, Jeff Hoon, tells The Guardian.
Frankly, without being unkind to existing electric vehicles, they won't be slightly odd. They will be cars that conform to appropriate safety standards and people use on an everyday basis.
Also today, why America faces a threat of homegrown extremism.
The people who worry about most of the lone wolves, you know, the sort of the one-man militant like Timothy McVeigh.
And the battle against cyber warfare. You'll go inside NATO's cyber defence headquarters in Estonia.
It's a very big challenge for us to be able to leverage networks and the power of computers while at the same time securing them.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton has the news headlines and today's papers.
The government's to offer drivers incentives of up to £5,000 to buy an electric car. Plans being unveiled today for a green revolution on the roads will also outline the creation of electric car cities across the UK and the introduction of large-scale experiments with ultra-low-carbon vehicles. The proposals are part of a £250 million strategy which aims to kickstart the market for cleaner travel and slash the UK's CO2 emissions. More on this later in the programme with The Guardian's environment correspondent. Civil servants exaggerated the seriousness of Home Office leaks, which led to the arrest of Tory MP Damian Green last November. That's the conclusion of an investigation by the All-Party Home Affairs Select Committee. The report also criticises the police operation, which was headed by Bob Quick. He resigned last week after causing a security lapse, which forced the early launch of a counter-terrorism operation. The committee likened police handling of Mr Green's arrest to the bungling Keystone Cops. The largest democratic ballot in history begins today as India goes to the polls. 700 million electors will cast their votes over 28 days, and 250,000 police officers will carry out a security operation to guard against the twin threats posed by Maoist rebels and jihadi terrorists. The incumbent Congress-led coalition government is facing a challenge from the main opposition BJP-led alliance. The two main blocs are also competing against a third front of communist and regional parties. Sport and Manchester United have seen off the threat of FC Porto to seal a Champions League semi-final tie against Arsenal. Cristiano Ronaldo scored the only goal of the match from 40 yards in the sixth minute. It means Man U's become the first English club to beat Porto on their own ground in European competition. Let's take a look at the papers now, and there's quite a variety of stories across the front pages today. The Mirror and The Sun offer photos and comment on yesterday's Hillsborough tribute. Justice for the 96, Hillsborough 20 years on, give us the truth, demands the Mirror, while the Sun carries a picture of a young mourner holding a placard saying, you'll never walk alone. The Independent reports on a row at the BBC with a front page photo of the corporation's Middle East correspondent Jeremy Bowen above the caption, under fire, BBC criticises its own coverage of the Middle East. But former Director General says it should not attack its own journalists. It follows the publication of a BBC Trust report which accuses Jeremy Bowen of breaching guidelines on accuracy and impartiality. The Times finds a new line on the Damien McBride scandal. Ministers braced for more smear emails. The paper says former aide Derek Draper has now been cut adrift by Labour as ministers prepare to face more damaging revelations. The Financial Times and The Mail both take a look ahead to next week's budget. The FT's headline is borrowing to hit £175 billion. If it does, that would be the worst public sector deficit since the Second World War. There's also a warning about the recent green shoots of recovery we've been hearing about. In an interview with the FT, the chief executive of the New York Stock Exchange says there'll be no real recovery until April of next year. Meanwhile, The Mail says Darling will admit years of tax hikes because of the economic turmoil we now find ourselves facing. And finally, The Telegraph reckons the most important story of the day is death of the traditional family. Latest figures from the Office for National Statistics show women are more likely to give birth than get married before they hit 25. Record numbers of people are living alone. And the number of single-parent households tripled between 1971 and 2008. One expert has told the paper that this is final confirmation that the nuclear family has become a museum piece. More up-to-the-minute news and comment throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Today, the government announces its strategy for putting more electric cars on the road. The Transport Secretary, Jeff Hoon, says there'll be incentives of up to £5,000 for consumers to buy electric cars. And British cities will be adapted to allow drivers to use and charge up their vehicles. Our green technology correspondent is Alok Jha. Alok, it's not the first time we've heard this about the electric car. How's this any different?
So electric cars, as you say, have been around since the 19th century. In fact, the first electric car was designed before the first diesel car. The reason they've never taken off before is usually down to a couple of things. One, the price of oil. Oil has been too cheap for anyone to design anything that runs on anything but oil. And secondly, the design of these things have been quite sort of wacky in the past. So if you're familiar with electric cars nowadays, you've got G-whizzes and other things that look like shopping trolleys on wheels. And so now they're actually much more normal looking. So you've got the BMW's Mini, you've got other mainstream manufacturers coming on board. And that was a point Jeff Hoon, the Transport Secretary, made to me.
I think the first place what we've got to get people used to is the idea that electric cars will become quite normal, quite usual, that people will have one, it won't be exceptional. And frankly, without being unkind to existing electric vehicles, they won't be slightly odd. They will be cars that conform to appropriate safety standards and people use on an everyday basis.
Alok, what's the government announcing today?
So the government is announcing a strategy of how to bring ultra-low carbon cars to you and me. That means electric or very efficient sort of plug-in hybrids. How to bring those cars into the mainstream. They're going to need a lot of help because cars, as we know them today, have been around for a long time. And actually, they're very cheap, they're very efficient. And so to bring in something new, to disrupt that market, you're going to need a lot of government help. And so they're announcing a huge amount of money to incentivize you and me to go out and buy these things.
And that's £5,000 each?
Up to £5,000 each, as Jeff Hoon says.
What I want to do with the money that we have available, around £250 million in the Department for Transport, is to essentially incentivise the consumer to ensure that the extra costs inevitably associated with innovation, and in particular in relation to electric vehicles, the still significant cost of batteries, is something that we help the consumer with in terms of providing a grant, a loan, some assistance to defray what in the early years of any innovatory cycle are always going to be higher costs.
So Alok, the background to this is that the government's got to reduce Britain's carbon emissions.
Well, the government has committed, this is abiding by law, that we have to reduce our carbon emissions by 26% by 2020 and 80% by 2050. This is an exceptionally difficult thing to do. And road transport is a major part of the emissions of the UK. And so if we can cut into that somehow, the government says, then we will go a long way to reaching those goals.
Something like 35% of all our carbon emissions are caused by domestic transport. Of domestic transport, something like 58% of domestic transport emissions are caused by motor cars. So you know, there's a huge contribution that reducing carbon emissions from motor cars can make to both our 2020 and our 2050 targets. So I think it's vitally important that we develop this area because of those targets.
So the big question, Alok, will it work?
Well, I hope so. As we said earlier, you know, if you could knock out something like 12% of the UK's carbon emissions, which are from cars, by doing electric cars, then you know that's such a long way to going and helping out in the world of climate change. There's one problem which this document doesn't really address, which is quite key. It's how do we fit in with the international scene? Because people like the US, Japan, Germany, and so on, they have their own electric car strategies that aren't quite the same as this. And the thing is that UK is a very small car market and we can do amazingly well for ourselves, but we really need to think about what the US and that lot are doing. Otherwise, there's not much point. And China as well.
Alok Jha, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/environment. Now, don't forget to vote for The Guardian's audio output, including Guardian Daily, in the People's Voice category of the Webby Awards. They're the Internet Oscars. You can do that at webbyawards.com. On the Guardian's website today, Stephen Moss on the campaign to save the swift, a bird that flies more than 20,000 kilometres a year. Changes in building methods and global warming mean that its days as a fixture of the British landscape could be numbered. Guardian.co.uk/environment. John Patterson interviews the director Werner Herzog at guardian.co.uk/film. And Adrian Searle reviews 19th century woodcuts at Birmingham's Icon Gallery at guardian.co.uk/arts. A combination of factors make America vulnerable to homegrown terrorists. An internal report from the US government says the economic recession and the fact that America now has a black president is fueling extremism. With the details in our Washington office is Ewan McCaskill.
Well, it's an astonishing report. It was never meant to be published. It was leaked. What it says, it's a report from the Department of Homeland Security, and it's warning of a real danger of a rise in right-wing extremist groups and the possibility of attacks. And it says that this is based on their analysis that because of the recession, then that leads to an increase in such groups. And also because it's the first black president, and this is a contributory factor as well. And there's a sort of third conclusion, and this is the one that seems to be generating the most controversy. It says that another contributory factor is the return of all these veterans from Iraq, and this has outraged veterans group such as the American Legion.
What about Barack Obama's policies? Are they having any effect on extremism one way or the other?
It is, yeah. The what's surprising, or maybe it shouldn't be surprising in America, there's a suggestion that Obama and the Democratic Congress might move to have a ban on some automatic or semi-automatic weapons. And this is resulted in a sort of backlash among the gun community in America, with lots of there's been a sort of shortage of ammunition, people sort of buying in bulk because they're scared there might be a ban. Now, if there was to be such a ban, then you could see a sort of kickback from gun groups, and that's sort of happening already. So that's one, but there's other sort of concerns. You know, Obama's prepared to sort of open the reform the immigration laws and effectively pardon the 12 million or so immigrants already in America, like mainly Mexican and from Latin America. And there's a lot of grievance against that. And it's not just Obama, it's the banking crisis. There's been a rise in, this report says there's been a sort of rise in sort of anti-Semitism, and it's sort of linked to the sort of banking sector and the financials sector in Wall Street.
Has the internet made the situation any more dangerous?
The context for this is saying that, you know, up until the early 90s, there was an increase in extremism groups, and we had Waco and the Oklahoma bombing. And then because the economy got better, and there's a decrease, and now they're worried it's on the rise again. And one of the factors that they cite is the internet, because the internet makes it easier for these groups to swap information, about plans, about anti-presidency, anti-establishment rhetoric, and also sort of to plot together. And the people who worry about most are the lone wolves, you know, the sort of the one-man militant like Timothy McVeigh that might take action. And the internet makes it easier for these lone wolves to gather information.
Ewan McCaskill in Washington. This is Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Still to come, are TV property programmes partly to blame for encouraging buy-to-let and driving up house prices? Kirsty Allsop thinks not.
When they want to have kids and whether they plan on getting married, why on earth are they buying a house together? And that, funnily enough, is when people ask me that question, do I feel guilty and do I feel responsible? I probably should have been even more strident in saying to people, because I have said it a lot, and said it till I'm blue in the face, don't even think about buying a house until you've had those discussions about your future.
But first, Western intelligence chiefs are discussing the possibilities and implications of a coordinated strike via the internet that targets businesses, public services, central government, the financial sector, and communication systems. Our technology correspondent, Bobby Johnson, visited the Estonian capital Tallinn, where NATO's computer experts are attempting to prevent a global cyber war.
I've travelled to the Estonian capital, Tallinn, to meet with some of the scientists and experts who are working at the Cooperative Cyber Defence Centre of Excellence. That's a multinational academy for internet warfare that's being backed by NATO. The multi-million pound facility is basically the Alliance's nerve centre for internet-based warfare and online counter-terrorism operations. And although it doesn't officially open until next month, I've come here to find out what goes on and to see precisely how seriously we should be taking the issue of cybersecurity. Okay, so here I am at the entrance to the centre. It feels pretty isolated. It's down a long, winding road on the south side of Tallinn that takes you past a couple of fairly grim Soviet-looking housing projects and through a small industrial estate. Now, the centre's actually on a military base, so one half here is given over to barracks. There's some soldiers marching around, a few jeeps here and there. I think over there that's some kind of missile or other heavy weaponry. But there's no time to go and have a look right now, because here's our guide.
My name is Mighty Stuhr, and welcome to the Cooperative Cyber Defence Centre of Excellence. So, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, can we go in and have a look?
We can to some extent. You'll see soon. The building itself, it was built for the Tsar's army, and it was used during the Soviet time as a military base as well. And now it was renovated for the purposes of Estonian National Defence.
Okay. And we've got some doors here that are
Okay, technically
cannot enter.
Yeah, so these are the areas we're not able to go to.
What goes on behind those doors?
Core scientific work, where all the scientists that are sent by different nation states or the sponsoring states are working.
So basically what we're in now is a long corridor with kind of classrooms on either side.
Exactly. Technically, this part of the building is used for giving lectures and giving trainings for Estonian Defence Forces or whoever.
The centre's known locally as K5, but NATO doesn't actually run any operations from here. Instead, this is where the intelligence work, the threat analysis and disaster simulations take place. Sounds impressive, but is cyber warfare really a serious threat? Inside K5, I met some of the staff who work there. In a moment, we'll hear from Kenneth Gears. But first, I asked Rein Ottis, an Estonian scientist, what exactly the problems are.
I would say right now there's two categories of threats. One is the threats against private individuals and private companies, which mostly stems from organized crime. But since we are working on NATO issues, we are not that much concerned with normal crime, because it is very difficult to benefit this way by attacking NATO or a nation state. So we actually look at cyber attacks as a possible venue for dealing conflicts in the future and today, because this is definitely not science fiction anymore. We have plenty of examples where nation states have actually been involved, both on the offensive and on the defensive side.
My name is Kenneth Gears. I am from the U.S. Navy in Washington, specifically the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, or NCIS. We're all relying increasingly on the internet to get both daily chores done, but also from a military perspective to accomplish command and control, to win battles in the battlefield. And it's a very big challenge for us to be able to leverage networks and the power of computers while at the same time securing them from preventing your adversaries from exploiting what you're doing, and in the worst case scenario, actually invading your own infrastructure and using your own tools against you, or changing your own traffic to tell your troops to move in the wrong direction, or your missiles to fire on your own cities, anything within imagination.
Bobby Johnson reporting. 18 months ago, property programmes filled the TV schedules, but since the housing market crashed, they've been accused of inflating prices, encouraging people to buy properties they couldn't afford. Well, Kirsty Allsop was co-presenter of Location, 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 one of those programmes, and she told The Guardian's Hannah Poole she's not to blame for fuelling the credit crunch.
No. If someone comes to me who we've had on the show, or a private client, and says, you gave me the wrong advice, I bought the wrong house, I lost money, yes, then I would feel hugely guilty and hugely responsible. But in terms of what some people's personal loss, no, I don't, because the message that I've been doing for a long, long time is long term, long term. I mean, in the show, there's this sort of, it's almost become a cliche. We sit down with a young couple and I go, so, what are your plans, family plans? And Phil goes, you can't ask these people whether they're going to have a baby or not. And I turn to him and say, but they're buying a house. If they haven't discussed when they want to have kids and whether they plan on getting married, why on earth are they buying a house together? And that, funnily enough, is when people ask me that question, do I feel guilty and do I feel responsible? I probably should have been even more strident in saying to people, because I have said it a lot, and said it till I'm blue in the face, don't even think about buying a house until you've had those discussions about your future, where you want to go, what you're thinking of doing. And the idea of a young couple just saying, let's go and buy a house, without them. I mean, we have been in situations on the show where she said to me, not for 5 years, and he said to me, I'm hoping for next spring. And I've sent them packing. I've just said, go and have that conversation before you do any more house hunting. And we went to see a house in Hampshire yesterday, and the contributors really liked it. And I was talking to the agent, and he said, oh, someone's made an offer, but they haven't seen their mortgage advisor yet. So we're not taking the offer very seriously. And I just thought, Jesus wept. What have I been doing for the last 10 years? That I've done all this, I made this television show, and there are still people out there who go and house hunt prior to having a conversation with their mortgage advisor. If I'm responsible, it's because I didn't, stand higher and shout louder that this is a serious process and there's a thing. And I wrote a book about it, How to Buy a House, saying, this is what you must do. Do not even think about going out there until you have calculated your finances. And the thing I've always said is, when you calculate your mortgage, think about interest rates going up by between 2 and 3%. I never said think about interest rates coming down by 5%.
So, I'm a first-time buyer.
Yeah.
What do I do?
You go and see your mortgage company.
Now? No, but in terms of getting, do I buy now? Do I wait?
Oh. It totally depends on your personal circumstances to do with finance, your level of deposit, your employment prospects, where you want to buy, what you want to buy, how you see your life progressing. If you're a first-time buyer of 21 or a first-time buyer of 31, if you're a first-time buyer with a committed partner, what you have to bear in mind is that prices could drop further. There are two camps at the moment. There's the dead cat bounce people who think that some of the perkiness we found January, February is a dead cat bounce. Or there are the people who believe that the appalling lack of supply that we have in this country, with less house buildings than any time since the First World War, and the fact that the population has gone up by 5 million in the last 15 years and is continuing to do so, means that regardless of the fact that unemployment has gone over 2 million for the first time in 12 years, etc., etc., that the market is controlled by supply and demand, and as soon as there's any liquidity in the mortgage markets, it will be like a starting pistol and you could get killed in the rush. I am a conservative member of the latter camp.
Kirsty Allsop, whose new programme, Kirsty's Homemade Home, is on Channel 4 tonight at 8 o'clock. Now, 20 years after Britain's worst football stadium disaster, a service was held in Liverpool yesterday in memory of the victims of the Hillsborough tragedy. Matt Weaver reports from Anfield.
I'm on Anfield Road and I've just bumped into a man in an Everton shirt. What's your name, sir?
Roger.
And what are your memories of that day?
My memories of that day is basically me and my mate was down from Scotland and we were out and I think we were at Southport or somewhere like that, and then next minute we heard like there'd been a riot at Hillsborough, and basically we seen that there was 53 dead. Obviously it went up to 95 and then 96, and consequently my mate was there, Gordon Owen, i.e. Gopher, and he turned around and he said we didn't hear nothing from him. And then about 1:30 in the morning there was a knock on the door from Sheffield Constabulary, and his mum answered the door, and basically he had Gordon's jacket in his hand and just said, is this your son's jacket? And the whole world just fell apart then.
What are your memories of Gordon?
Oh, he was a good lad. He was a good lad. He was a Protestant. He was in the lodge, played the flute in the band, and the band and everything was there at his funeral. And there was Alan Anson, Steve Nichol, and Kenny Dalglish. And it was just the most horrible time I think this city's ever had.
And you've come down in your Everton colours. It's a day that the city unites.
Well, it's the day the city unites. My missus now, she's a red. I'm a blue. My dad's a blue. My mum's a red. It's a mixed city. And this is the way it should be. It shouldn't be. Football's football. You know what I mean? Yeah, you'd have your banter with your red and your blue. But at the end of the day, it's just a football game. 96 lives got lost that day. And there's still no justice for it. And there should be some justice for it. The police should be answerable to what they've done that day.
Do you think there's any chance they will be?
I hope so, because the simple reason being, it should never have happened. They should never have opened them gates.
Just behind the cop end now, and I've come across two gentlemen with red roses in their hands. What are your names, fellas?
Yeah, my name's Steve.
And my name's Derek.
And why are you here? Sorry.
Well, obviously come to support the 96 people who lost their lives at Hillsborough, but more important to make it a day that will never be forgotten, ever.
And who are the roses for?
Well, obviously for all 96, but we did have a few friends there that we actually knew, which was Peter Toodle and Ian Glover from Walton, so we'd like to put the roses on for them.
What do you remember about over the day?
I was actually in work that day, and when it all started off, before around about 3:20, all rumours started coming through that it was getting bad. But I actually we had relatives there as well. We had three nephews there, and it was just a panic. Can we get in touch with them? How can we find out if, you know? And as the hour was going past, and it just got worse and worse, and then it was just the sheer dread that one of your family is there and is caught in the crush. And as it turned out, my brother Tony, he was whacked by the two young ladies, the Hicks girls, who passed away. And he actually seen them, and he's still haunted by that. He'll never get over the sight, what he's seen in those two girls, ever.
Tell us about your friend.
Which friend?
Peter.
He was a friend of a relative of ours, and we actually went to his funeral along with Kenny Dalglish. And he was a lively character, full of fun, you know, and just lost his life too young, supporting a team that he absolutely loved.
And do you think today helps the city kind of get over it?
The city will never get over Hillsborough. No, the city will never. As long as I live, I will never get over it. I'll never forget that day as long as I live. And the after effects and what the Sun newspaper done. And if I still see anybody reading the Sun newspaper now, I'll look at them with total disgust. And I will do to my dying day.
So there's still lots of anger here?
Oh, very much so. But more so now, because it's all been brought to light again. You'll see a lot of stickers around saying, still do not buy the Sun, don't buy the Sun. And you still get the odd people that do. But the people who buy the Sun are mainly old ladies, only for the bingo, because that's the only thing it's good enough for, and then to use in the toilet.
And you said, who's your flower for?
It's the same people, same friends, yeah.
We were with a couple of the lads the night before doing a charity 24-hour pool match in Walton, and obviously we knew they were going the match and they never came back.
Matt Weaver reporting. Phil Maynard and Doug Hardy produced today's show. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.